protein is so important, and what they need to do is to go buy a white gerbil, take it to one of the fine tattoo parlors in your neighborhood, have 85-13 tattooed on its back. So every night when you come home and you pet your gerbil, you will see 85-13.
Welcome to Trust Hacker, the podcast for elder and special needs law attorneys hacking their way out of the trust and tax jungle and seeking the sunny uplands of trust nirvana. And now, here's your guide, Bob Mason.
My guest of this episode is one of the nation's leading estates and trust attorneys. He's a former regent of the American College of Trust and Estate Counsel, a former head of the estate planning practice of Milbank, Tweed, Hadley, and McCloy, a founder of Interactive Legal Services, and a principal in Pioneer Wealth Partners, a high-end wealth management advisory firm in Manhattan. He's an incredibly prolific writer and author, and if you hadn't heard of him by now, there's something wrong with you, because in this episode, we're going to hack the incredible Jonathan Blotmacher.
The Trust Hacker is brought to you by TrustChimp, an educational resource for attorneys attempting to hack their way out of the confusing jungles of public benefits and tax law and to reach the sunny uplands of trust nirvana. Sign up for a free membership at TrustChimp.com. Gain access to educational membership materials, have the latest newsletters and articles delivered to your inbox, and stay in the loop on the latest offerings at TrustChimp. That's TrustChimp.com.
Jonathan, welcome to the Trust Hacker.
Well, thank you, Bob. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, it's really an honor to have you here. Let's just jump right into this. Something I've always wondered about with you is, how did you end up at Columbia? For that matter, how did you end up being an attorney? And maybe more specific than that, what on earth made you decide to be an estates, trusts, and tax attorney?
Bob, to me, that's obviously an interesting question. I'm not sure it is to anyone else, but it was almost by default. I majored in math and economics in college. I was signed up for a PhD in math, a PhD in economics, and also to get an MBA at the Wharton School, which Donald Trump will tell you is the greatest school in the world. But my father had gone to Columbia Law School, and he very much wanted me to follow in his footsteps. He was dying as I was getting out of college. He had been a heavy smoker and had severe emphysema. And I wasn't sure what the future would hold for me, so I decided to go to law school. And Columbia was the place to go. In fact, I only applied to Columbia and NYU, which is where my father's brother went, and went to Columbia and had a great experience. When I got out, I started working for a short time for one of the great law firms in the United States, Simpson Thacher and Bartlett. And you had to rotate through five departments. And I started in trust and estates merely because I had done some trust and estates work for my father's law firm during law school. And I then went into the Army for 2 years, and only was at Simpson Thacher for 4 months. But when I went back there, they said I had done so well, they wanted me to make that my permanent position, and I was so honored that they could think that I would do something well that I accepted. So it really was kind of by default, not choice, Bob, as to how I got into the field that I've now spent almost 50 years in.
Well, everyone has heard of Jonathan Blotmacher. I don't know whether I'm exaggerating to call you the dean of the country's estate and tax attorneys, but you're certainly up there near the top of the heap. What is the one thing that you do or that you have done that you feel has contributed the most to your success over the years? And by the way, keep it non-technical.
Well, I think, Bob, is that ever since I was a little boy, it's not a matter of intelligence, it's a matter of attitude. I've thought outside the box. And I often wound up challenging my teachers, not because I was trying to be difficult, but because I just did not understand. I just couldn't accept it. Why is that true? Why can't it be done this way as opposed to another way? And for example, when I got into the practice of law at Simpson Thacher, and this was the way it was done throughout the entire country, If you used a trust for descendants, there would be payouts at various ages, typically 25 and 30, or 25, 30, and 35. And I began to question, why was that the case? And I pushed it and pushed it, and today I think I've moved that thing tremendously over to the point where I think most informed attorneys now start with a premise that things will be in trust, essentially for as long as local law provides. And that's just an example of one of the things that I've done that's had a big impact. Again, nothing to do with intelligence, but it had to do with attitude about questioning, can't we do better? What is our goal? Why accept the way things were? And so I think that's made me a little bit different than the average bear out there.
So take persistence and take thinking outside of the box. Which is more important, or do you rate them equally?
It depends. I think it's very difficult to say one is more important than another. I think they're both critically important. Obviously, the most important thing is to try to do the best job you can for your clients, and people may disagree as to what's in the best interest of the client, but it always pays off best for the counselor in the long run. Do what is the very, very best for your client. Offer them the very best. They may disagree at the end of the day, and another person might say, no, there's a better way to accomplish the goal. But that is the most important thing, rather than, you know, getting the biggest fee or trying to get additional business from someone. That I am confident of.
Well, as you look back, if you had, say, 15 minutes in your career that you could do over again, I mean, that you wish you could do over again, you know, what do you consider the high point that you look back on and you just smile at?
Bob, you're asking what I would do different than what I did?
No. What I'm asking is what are you proudest of, that pinnacle where you look back and you go, yes.
I think, Bob, it was going back to what I said before, convincing my clients to put virtually all of their wealth in trust. I mean, I've saved my clients literally billions of dollars of taxes. I have been very, very successful in that. In fact, once in a deposition, the lawyer accused me of being significantly responsible for the national debt. I actually took that as a compliment. But the thing that I'm most proud of is that I've been able to convince my clients to put it all in trust, even things like tangible personal property and homes, which most lawyers will say is absolutely crazy. I'm more happy about that than anything I've done. Also, one thing is starting the company known as Interactive Legal, where we provide basically a drafting system using document assembly and an artificial intelligence system, which I believe to date is the only one in existence which provides true artificial intelligence to help an attorney in certain areas make an unbiased, objective decision. For example, should your client do an installment sale to a grantor trust? Should your client create a charitable remainder trust and things such as that? That was the hardest work I ever did, and I'm very, very proud as the way it is, and I will stack up the conclusions that the computer reaches to any practitioner in the United States.
Okay, well, you put a thought in my head. Let's flip that over. As you look back, and I guess this happens to all of us, what would you consider the low point? I mean, it was just a terrible time, and I hope I never have to look at something like that again.
Yeah, I was sued by a client. I had to go to trial. I won, but the client accused me of doing wrong by him, and actually I tried to do well by him. In fact, previously, he had come in and asked me to do something for him, which actually my firm and I would have made a lot of money on. I mean, a lot of money. And I said, this is not right for you, and I turned it down. But obviously being sued was the absolutely worst thing that could happen. It's now very common for lawyers to be sued. There are two very prominent trust and estates lawyers here in New York City who have been sued. I know nothing about the merits of their cases, but when you try to do the best thing you can for a client, and yet they turn around and come back at you because they're unhappy with the result, or someone told them they should be unhappy with the result, that's obviously a pretty low point in your entire life.
You and I have discussed before my theory about, and it's something I came up with because I started my legal career in the estate tax area and morphed into being an elder law attorney, but what I have said, including at the Interactive Legal Trust Summit, or at the summit in Manhattan a few months ago, estate tax planners are from Mars, elder law attorneys are from Venus. We operate off the same celestial charts, but work in different atmospheres. So if I ask you a question that veers into elder law, you can head me back the other way, but I'm interested in hearing your take on a few things from an estate tax planner standpoint. But one thing, as well connected as you are, I'd be interested in hearing what you think the biggest challenge facing the estate planning or elder law bar over the next 5 to 10 years will be.
Well, I think there are a number of challenges that are going to occur, and I think they're going to happen quite rapidly. One is the fact that there are so many competitors out there now, things like Rocket Lawyer and LegalZoom, and there's going to be more of that, and the melding of the practice of law, whether it's in estate tax or whether it's in elder law, is going to basically morph into more or less a commodity. And practitioners have got to be aware of that, and they have to be not just aware it's going to happen, they have to react to that change, and it's going to happen very, very quickly, I believe. In fact, in many countries in the world now, there's no such thing as the unauthorized practice of law unless you're going into a courtroom. But in England, I understand there's a bill now pending in Canada. In fact, if you go to Walmart in Canada, you can have your wills done. Now, it's done by attorneys, but you now have a commercial company, publicly traded, which is offering legal services. And those lawyers work for Walmart in Canada, by the way. The United States can try to resist it, but like most things, if the rest of the world is doing it and people are happy about it and it appears to service customers, the United States is going to have to go the same way. In fact, there are many states now that permit what they call legal document assistants. These are non-lawyers. They're basically the equivalent of a paralegal. That's true in Arizona, that's true in California, it's true in Florida, and it is also now true in the state of Washington, and it will become much, much more common in the United States. So there's going to be a lot of competition, and lawyers have to be aware that they have to be much more efficient in rendering legal services, or what we've historically viewed as legal services, to their customers.
Well, can lawyers even be efficient enough to compete with, well, the Walmarts of the world?
Well, that's a great question. I'm not sure on just preparing a document you can. I wrote an article in 2010 called The Future of the Practice of Law, and I actually went online and did a will using LegalZoom. As they often say, you get what you paid for. I felt it was not what was right for me. I didn't think it had the right choices. I didn't think it had the right explanation. But I couldn't compete because delivered, it was $71. And no lawyer is going to be able to do it. And in fact, Bob, I believe that the best way for lawyers to be able to compete is to tell their clients that they won't charge for the preparation of the legal documents if they're fairly standard. What they're going to charge for is the guidance that they're going to provide their clients, because you're not going to get it, at least today, from LegalZoom or Rocket Lawyer or some kind of institution or at Walmart. Now, Walmart has, you know, really living, breathing human lawyers there, but for the price you pay, you're not going to get great depth. And also, they're going to be limited on what they can do. So if you have someone who comes in with a disabled child, a mother with problems, you're having difficulties in your business and you're not sure what you should do, which may be much more than just legal advice, but some sort of general business advice. And the more experience a lawyer has in those areas, the better she's going to be able to really service her clients, which I don't think you're going to get off the computer, at least for about 5 to 10 years.
It seems to me, though, that one of the challenges to the attorneys is to get the consuming public thinking along those lines.
Well, that's right. I mean, today, for example, and maybe some of the people listening to this may want to try it, they go to YouTube and you type in revocable trust or irrevocable life insurance trust. I haven't checked it out, Bob, but even in the areas of elder law, my guess is that if you put in elder law or Medicaid planning, there will be dozens of free videos. Those videos are there, obviously, to promote the person who's making the video. She or he is hoping that you'll hear it and then you'll come to them for your legal services. But you can also inform yourself tremendously. So if you're going to go in and see, you know, a two-legged lawyer for real, and you want to find out whether a particular strategy is appropriate or what can be done, listening to some of those videos is going to be informative. Also, you can just go online and Google what you want, and my guess is that if you put in anything to do with Medicaid planning, you would get, I'll go on say there will be millions of hits you'll get on trying to provide you with information, and most of that will be absolutely for free. So you can start there and get yourself really up to the point where you have as much knowledge as possible as a consumer, and then go to the lawyer, and that's going to reduce the time the lawyer is going to need to really put you into the best position for what you're trying to accomplish.
And I agree with that. In my own practice, I feel like an informed client is much easier to deal with than one that I've got to get completely educated and looking at it from, I guess it would be the same from an estate tax standpoint, dealing with various tax authorities in the Medicaid area, dealing with various state authorities. Things are always changing, and no legal Zoom of the world is going to be able to make up for whatever the latest administrative pronouncement is or the latest administrative practice and the like.
I couldn't agree more.
My name is Amanda. I'm an elder law and estate planning attorney from Fayetteville, Arkansas. And the Trust Champ Summit was one of the most helpful COEs I've ever been to. My favorite part was that we didn't just talk about different topics, but we actually had breakout sessions where we worked on different problems so that when we went home, we knew how to apply what we learned. So I highly recommend it. You can check it out yourself at trustchamp.com/summit.
What is the one thing estate planning and elder law attorneys do that drives Jonathan Blotmacher nuts?
Well, I don't know if there's anything that drives them absolutely nuts. I think the underuse of trusts is probably my biggest overall complaint. In fact, I have a lecture I give about the importance of trusts in estate and financial planning. And I usually begin by asking the audience, consisting of lawyers, whether they're elder law lawyers or they're estate planning lawyers, do you ever do a trust under a will or a separate instrument where you have payout at various ages? Or do you ever prepare a will where you have things passed outright to people? And invariably, I get a majority of hands going up saying, yes, I do that. By the end of my lecture, I ask it again, how many will do that in the future? And usually not one hand goes up.
Hmm. Really? That surprises me. Hmm. I want to keep this on track because I know that you're on a schedule here. But I've got to make a confession to you. I have a snitch, someone who's been feeding me information, a former associate of yours at Milbank. And so I hear things. What is this about a hamster named 8513?
Well, 85-13, Revenue Ruling 85-13, is, in my view, probably the most important revenue ruling the IRS has ever issued for estate planners. It was a holding which had been hinted at previously but expressly held that a grantor trust, a trust from which the income is attributed back to the grantor, does not exist for income tax purposes. And indeed, everybody should read 85-13 because it involved a situation where a taxpayer was actually buying assets back from a trust and giving a note. And the Internal Revenue Service held that the purchase did not exist for income tax purposes, therefore there was no real debt, therefore the interest paid on that debt could not be deducted for federal income tax purposes. That led me and eventually others to many, many good strategies which can be used, for example, an installment sale to a grantor trust, where someone has a highly appreciated asset, which if sold normally would trigger a big gain and therefore a big tax, but by selling it to a grantor trust, and that would not cause the recognition of gain and the interest paid would not be subject to income tax, because that's what the Commissioner of Internal Revenue Services told us. And because you can basically make the interest on the debt very low, the so-called applicable federal rate, which runs today somewhere between 60 basis points and 260 basis points, depending upon the length of the term, it means you can sell that asset to a grantor trust, which although it's a grantor trust and therefore ignored for income tax purposes, is not ignored for estate and gift tax purposes, meaning that trust will be out of your estate. And where you have an asset which, either by reason of a discount taken when it's sold, or by reason of the interest rate being lower than the property generates once it's been purchased by that trust, provides an opportunity to get assets out of the estate, and at the same time, because it's a sale, those assets will no longer be subject to the claims of the former owner's creditors, including, typically, a spouse, because it's now been sold for full value, or you'll get it appraised and claim its full value, keeping in mind that for creditor purposes, you don't have to do it to the penny, it just has to be a fair value. So if you have an independent appraisal by an independent appraiser, nothing phony, nothing strange, it's very likely that not only will you get it out of your estate without any income tax friction whatsoever, but it will also be immunized from claims of creditors. And the note that you get back from the trust typically has a very low value in the real world. I mean, if you sell property and you're not going to be paid for 9 years or it's not going to be paid for 25 years or something like that, and maybe the interest will merely accrue, that note to a third party is probably worth very little at this time, providing you to put yourself in a position where the fear of a claim by a creditor is probably significantly reduced. And that's, Bob, why I tell people that 8513 is so important, and what they need to do is to go buy a white gerbil, take it to one of the fine tattoo parlors in your neighborhood, have 85-13 tattooed on its back. So every night when you come home and you pet your gerbil, you will see 85-13. In addition, when that gerbil eventually dies, you can take it to one of the fine taxidermists in your neighborhood and have that hide tanned, and then just nail that up to your inside of your kitchen door. So every time you're going out, you will see 85-13. And I'm not kidding, Bob, when I say this to people. It will be best if you will read 85-13. Not only will it reinforce its importance to you, but you will see the IRS's reasoning of it, and it sounds like good reasoning, and that's going to help you remember, and because you'll remember it, you'll be in a position to apply it in a lot more circumstances where you might not think about it otherwise.
You had mentioned something a moment ago that triggered a thought, and again, this is of where the typical estate tax planner is concerned about keeping an asset out of the estate. Quite often, the elder law attorney, when it gets down to what their overarching goal it is, it might be to receive stepped-up basis in an asset. So they'll take the easy route and make sure that whatever trust they're putting it into is going to be includable. under, you know, 2036 or 2038 in the deceased estate. Never mind, they'll never have to file a 706. Where do you think we're going with stepped-up basis? I noticed that the current administration budget, which I don't think is going to go anywhere in this political climate, but the current budget seeks to eliminate stepped-up basis. You know, do you have any feel for that? Or I guess it's tough to ask, you know, until after the elections.
Well, Bob, as you may know, one of my two great claims to fame is I wrote the only book ever about carryover basis. Because in the Tax Reform Act of 1976, which was signed into law by Gerald Ford on October 4, 1976, you did not get a stepped-up basis. The basis carried over subject to a number of relatively complex adjustments. And I wrote a book, and it made me a pretty famous young lawyer, and I got to testify before the Congress about it, and it really put me on the map. But the Congress eventually repealed it in 1980. Whether or not that will ever come back is tough to say. The one time I think it might politically happen, certainly not with a strong Republican House and Senate you have, is if they made a deal to move to something like the Canadian system. Canada, up until the early 1970s, had an estate tax system very much like the American system. My understanding, there was a 50% marital deduction, there was a similar exemption, very similar rules. Canada repealed its federal estate tax, and it put in a capital gains tax at death, except if it was left to the surviving spouse, basis would carry over. That kind of system avoids the onerous double tax claim that a lot of people say the estate tax does. It just means that you've basically been treated as selling the asset, and whether you sell it before death, or you intended to sell it after death, from a tax perspective, it doesn't matter because there will be capital gains tax at death. In fact, if you move into Canada, your assets get a stepped-up basis. And while you're in Canada, if you make a gift of the property, that will cause capital gain. If you sell it, obviously, it will cause capital gain. Or if you die with it, it will cause capital gain, except if it's going to your spouse. Or if you move out of the country, they will hit you with a capital gain. That, to me, is a more consistent system than the one we have in the United States, where we have these three things working at us. One, don't sell your property ever because you're going to have to pay capital gains tax, hold it until you die, searching for the step up in basis, which is the second thing. But then the fear is that if you hold it until you die, then you're going to wind up having to pay an estate tax if your estate is large enough. I don't think today, politically, there's much of a chance of a radical change of any kind. If the Republicans keep the Senate, keep the House, and win the presidency, it may be possible that you'll have a repeal of the federal estate tax, which you have for everybody today if you have basically $5.5 million or less, or for a married couple, $11 million or less. And maybe just have a carryover basis system. It seems, however, and I've spoken to Canadian lawyers about this, that a capital gains tax at death is a much more sensible system, because at that time, you'll have to figure out what the decedent's basis was in the property and take care of it. And that probably makes a lot of sense.
I know you're on a tight schedule here, and I promised to get you out on time. Do you have time for one more quick question?
Sure.
Okay. You and I have also discussed this. In the Medicaid environment, as you know, there is a fairly extensive regime of set of rules, statutory, regulatory, about what happens if you transfer assets within 5 years of making a Medicaid application. There are rules pertaining to estate recovery and the like. And accordingly, a lot of attorneys set up irrevocable trusts, transfer assets into those, and the trust, you know, accomplish those goals. But what some people have begun to wonder about is whether there ought to be concerns about some states slapping a fraudulent conveyance claim on top of all of that. Later on saying, well, fine, but we think it's a fraudulent conveyance. What say you?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, and it may turn on peculiar state law. New York has a rule that says if you make a transfer and it leaves you essentially insolvent as of that moment, it does constitute a fraudulent transfer. And I don't know of any exception under that law where you're trying to do Medicaid planning of one kind or another. Other states, and probably the majority in the federal rule, is you have to have an intention to try to hinder, delay, or defraud a creditor. And if you have an intent to hinder, delay, or defraud a creditor, you have a problem. However, I think if you're doing true Medicaid planning, I don't think it's going to apply for two reasons. First, there are federal rules as to what you can do, and if you have a federal rule saying you can do it this way and we will respect it, to allow some collateral attack on fraudulent conveyance seems extremely unlikely to me to survive some sort of motion to dismiss. Second, because it is a five-year rule, and the fact that under the law of almost all states, the fraudulent conveyance period is under 5 years, that it's just going to be barred by the statute of limitations. The bottom line, although I know of no law on point, I think that the chances of someone, some state, being able to successfully claim that when you transfer this property to your son, your daughter, whomever it might be, that you were guilty of some sort of fraudulent transfer because you were trying to keep your assets from becoming subject to claims for your nursing home care, for example, I think it probably would fail. But it's an excellent question you've asked.
Thanks, Jonathan. And this has been just great. I'll tell you what, as promised, why don't you take a minute or two to tell the listeners what you're up to, how they can reach you, or where you would like to point them out there on the great World Wide Web.
Well, I actually have five or six jobs, depending upon how you count them, although my wife is a little unhappy. But one of the things, as I mentioned a little earlier, Bob, that I've been involved in, and one of the things that I'm most proud of, because I think it will have some staying power, my tax gimmick, so to speak, the IRS or the Congress has shut many of those down and will in the future. But it's the ability to assist attorneys in their practice by making them more efficient, such as with our program, Wealth Transfer Planning, which is in a document assembly system and also provides artificial intelligence to assist in making decisions. We also have an elder law product which works in a similar manner. And people can go online at ILS, Interactive Legal Systems, ILS.com, and explore and see if we have something that they would be interested in. We have our own basically listserv where people every day post questions or comments, and it's quite active. And I've actually had people tell me that they would pay for that alone for what they're paying, but the fact that they're getting all these other things, including the ability to ask questions in complex areas, and we have both elder law attorneys like Letha McDowell and Steve Silverberg, and great estate planning attorneys like Howard Zaritsky, who will respond to questions and without charge.
Jonathan, this has been wonderful. I want to keep you on your schedule. I don't want to impose on your time anymore, but I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to us.
And Bob, I am honored that you've given me this opportunity to talk about things that I think are important to the world.
Totally my pleasure. Jonathan,
thanks.
It's been great.
Bye-bye.
Bye. The great Jonathan Blotmacher. One of the frustrating things about having Jonathan with us is I had so much else I wanted to ask. And I'm going to see what I can do to get him back to the Trust Hacker. He said so much that caught my attention, but I finally settled on a hack. That one piece of advice that resonated, and as is so often the case, it wasn't technical. Did you catch it? Listen and see if you agree.
It's not a matter of intelligence, it's a matter of attitude. I've thought outside the box. And I often wound up challenging my teachers, not because I was trying to be difficult, but because I just did not understand. I just couldn't accept it. Why is that true? Why can't it be done this way as opposed to another way? Nothing to do with intelligence, but it had to do with attitude about questioning. Can't we do better? What is our goal? Why accept the way things were? And so I think that's made me a little bit different than the average bear out there.
There you have it. You have to master the rules. That's brute effort and intelligence. But it's the attorney who can think outside the box who's going to make it. Master the rules, but then go beyond the rules, and you'll do just fine. I'm going to wind it up there. Get over to TrustChimp.com for a free membership and to get in on whatever is the latest going on with us, or go to TrustChimp.com/summits to get the latest news on the next TrustChimp Trust Summit. And on that, I'm out of here.
TrustChimp.com.